Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and this is Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Well, it's very nice to have you with us once again on the program. Today we're doing something different, and that's because this is the last edition of Focus Asia Pacific for 2012. So over the next 30 minutes, we're going to be bringing you two reports that we aired this past year that received the most mail from you, the listener. Stay tuned. This is Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. A few weeks ago, China's Communist Party announced a new leader. After 8 years, Chinese President Hu Jintao is stepping down from the world's most populous nation as its leader. Its new leader, Xi Jinping, has his work cut out for him. Over the past year, we've seen a lot of scandal within China's Communist Party. There was the whole Bo Xilai scandal. Bo Xilai was sent to prison, and this involves the death of a British businessman by the name of Neil Haywood. So, yes, there are cracks in the system. After it was announced that Xi Jinping was elected by the members of the Communist Party as the new leader of China, we spoke to our own Jocelyn Ford.
They did, but there was, you know, some question marks until the very last minute whether they really would pare down the top leadership to 7 positions or leave it at 9. And so, you know, that wasn't known, so to speak. I wouldn't say there are any big surprises, but one of the things that some of the folks who'd been hoping for more reform, political reform, broader, more anti-corruption, were disappointed that 2 people who were seen as leading reformers did not make it into the top 7. So that was something.
Now, if we look at the top 7, how would you describe this top 7? Were they chosen because they're going to play it safe?
Well, let me say this, first of all. I was here 10 years ago when Hu Jintao came in, and I tell you, his speech was, you know, you couldn't tell what the guy was thinking. You felt like he had a huge, great wall built around him to close him off from the world. And it was sort of a breath of fresh air today when Xi Jinping came in, and he just seemed like an ordinary guy that you could actually relate to. He seems comfortable in his skin. He seems like he might be a leader who would get along with leaders from other countries. So that was sort of something pleasant, which I felt when just watching him speak. He didn't do a lot of slogans. He actually chatted a lot longer than Hu Jintao did 10 years ago when he came to power. So that was nice. Then you had the rest of the usual show and tell of these guys all in the dark suits, standing very stiffly, you know, and you didn't get much of a feeling for the other personalities, but that's sort of par for the course for the China's Communist Party.
Now, with this happening, is there any speculation yet on what could be expected? Because Hu Jintao is actually leaving as president of China next year, early next year, and that position will be taken over by Xi Jinping. So, of course, in the next few months, there's not going to be any type of major transformation in either domestic policy or foreign policy. But are people already speculating now that there could be some changes in these areas?
Well, you know, consistency, more policy, the same as usual. The Chinese Communist Party is usually run by consensus. These are all sort of the old tunes that one tends to hear. I'm more of I think the personality of the top leadership does matter. And if you look deep into the backgrounds of the 7 people, 2 of them are quite, shall we say, conservative, keep a lid on the country, don't reform too quickly, please. One of them is Liu Yunshan, who's part of the censorship apparatus. And so, you know, that's why some people aren't feeling terribly encouraged. However, when you look into their backgrounds, a number of them, I believe I counted 3, had actually been brought in to clean up crises when other politicians had problems. Either one with SARS didn't handle SARS very well. Other corruption, sort of anti-corruption. So there is some sort of hope that there could be a stronger anti-corruption move on the part of this cabinet. One thing, Wang Qishan, he is a very strong economics leader. He is supposedly going to be put in charge of fighting corruption. He's a former banker. He knows the industry. He probably knows how it works. And the word among Chinese is that since he has no kids, he's the perfect guy to fight corruption because it's usually the families that are involved. So anyway, we'll see where that heads. But I find this rather intriguing.
Now, of course, you were talking about corruption. And I mean, there was a lot of talk about cracking down on corruption. This is China's future. We have to crack down on corruption. But this seems like the same record that's being played over and over. It's not the first time that we've heard this.
That's absolutely true. And it certainly won't be the last time we've heard it. So the question will be, what sort of action will you see? I think there's some road signs out there to look for. One is, is the media going to be given any more leeway? Because the media has been key, and especially what's going on the internet, on the China's Twitter, the Weibo, they've outed a lot of corrupt officials, and that's become sort of a watchdog. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with media under this new top leadership. I think it'll be interesting to see how Bo Xilai, the guy who was going to be in the top leadership, but his wife was involved with the murder of a British guy, and he has been kicked out of the party. It'll be interesting to see how his case is cleaned up. Now, I wouldn't expect any major changes, and people expect a show trial. Could very well be a show trial without a lot of facts coming out. But that would be another key thing to look for, because one thing of interest is that Xi Jinping and presumably the next prime minister, Li Keqiang, both have some sort of legal background. And this is the first time that you will have people with a strong legal background taking over the government. So the question is, will the judicial system be given any more independence from the Communist Party, which is sort of a key to cracking down on corruption? So these are some of the things to look for.
But, other experts that I've spoken to, Jocelyn, they say the problem with cracking down on corruption in China is that, okay, Beijing may have a strategy in place and they want to really get rid of corruption with, not just within the Communist Party, but in all different sectors of Chinese society and also in commerce as well. But when it comes to, let's say, the provinces, how much is Beijing willing to pressure the provinces where there is a tremendous amount of corruption, but also Beijing gets a lot of their support from the regions and the provinces. How willing do you think these leaders are to really go after the problem?
Well, one thing is willingness and the other thing is ability. And as you've said, it's a huge country and there's a lot of independent minded people out in the provinces, and it's just hard to, enforce whatever rules or regulations they may put in place. So this is a big, a big tough nut. But if it gets, too bad, the thing is that the government is more sensitive to public opinion than certainly it was 10 years ago, for example. You're hearing a lot more voices. If this gets too out of hand, there is a certain amount of nervousness that, they could lose a grip on the country. So if they feel pressured by the public to take more action, it may be just for show, but we could see a little bit more in this direction. I wouldn't be too hopeful, though.
Now let's talk about foreign policy for a moment. I mean, we've seen that the United States is expanding their reach in Asia. They've just built a military complex in the northern tip of Australia. There's also the conflict with Korea, and there's reports coming out that this past week, and in the past few weeks, in fact, North Korea has been testing new rockets. Do you think that with this new leadership change, because the personalities are very different, they may take, let's say, a harder line on North Korea, and also maybe a harder line on the United States expanding its reach in Asia?
I think, anything is possible if the new leadership feels they have to prove themselves being tough on other countries. Is a way to go. But as I was saying, I mean, Xi Jinping is he is much more internationally minded than Hu Jintao was. From everything I've heard, Hu Jintao just was not comfortable meeting foreigners. He would avoid it at all costs. If he absolutely had to, he would. And Xi Jinping isn't like that. He's dealt with a lot of foreign businesses in his earlier posts as in some of the coastal provinces with the booming economies. He spent some time in the U.S. He's made something like 6 trips there. He, you know, was famous for being in Iowa. He's sort of a populist in the sense that he has hobbies and a personality. So if he leverages that, I'd like to hold out a vague hope that he could help improve international relations because foreign leaders may be able to identify with him. So that's one thing. And on North Korea, it's of interest that one of the 7, Jang Dejang, is actually studied in North Korea and worked up near the border there. So I it'll be interesting to see whether his ties that go back way back when, how they play out.
And that was our Beijing correspondent, Jocelyn Ford, talking about the new leader of China, Xi Jinping, a few weeks ago. October 12th was the 10th anniversary of the Bali bombings, where more than 200 people died with more than 200 injured after an Islamic terrorist group bombed a popular nightclub. We now bring you the special report that we did on that date. 88 Australians were killed, along with 32 Indonesians, 24 Britons, as well as citizens from the US and Europe. Last week, memorial services were held in Australia and Indonesia and other places to commemorate those who died. In Canberra, Australia's Governor General Quinton Bryce and Indonesian Charge d'Affaires at the embassy, Wiwat Shawati, addressed the national service.
As the warmth of morning sun announces a new day in Bali, we come together. As waves wash ashore at Kuta, cleansing yesterday's footprints from the sand, we comfort each other. As starlings swoop above the cliffs of the commemorative site at GWK, we gather as one. People from across Australia join in solidarity and support, in love and friendship, to remember. Fathers, mothers, husbands, wives, brothers, sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, cousins, colleagues, lovers, mates. The unbearable pain and grief that pierced our hearts 10 years ago. We remember futures cut short, potential snatched away in a heartbeat, lives left shattered. That fateful night, the unspeakable horror of terrorism came to our backyard as 88 Australians went about enjoying a peaceful holiday, as they have done on thousands of nights, footy teams, families, cobbers. An act of barbarism changed everything. 202 precious lives lost, hundreds injured, all of us left changed forever.
Ago, the people of Bali went to work and pray, as usual, still struggling through the multi-dimensional crisis that swept Indonesia a few years earlier in 1998. The working Balinese greet the island's visitors with a caring smile. The praying Balinese went about their religious rituals, praying to the gods exactly the way they have done for centuries. But unfortunately, the god had other plans that night. Indonesia, often called the land of 1,000 smiles, that particular evening turned into the land of 1,000,000 sorrows. The act of a few extremists had taken the lives of peace-loving Balinese and innocent expatriates, most of them from our largest and closest neighbors, Australia. All Indonesians felt anger as to why this happened. And why this happened in Bali. Most of all, 220 million Indonesians felt deep sympathy for all the life lost, the Australian life lost, and for those families and friends left behind. In a land when hospitality is a reverse practice and guests are treated like royalty, the Balinese quickly turned to helping those injured and bringing them to care. In times of crisis, as neighbors and friends, we can console and comfort each other.
10 years ago, visitors from around the world were enjoying a night out at the Sari Club in Bali's Ketu district, along with the Indonesian nationals. The presence of foreigners made the club a target for Islamist terrorists who set off explosions so powerful they tore apart the venues and left deep craters in the ground. Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard attended the special memorial in Bali, where she addressed those attending. Also in attendance was the former Prime Minister John Howard.
We gather here, we gather together, to commemorate the worst terrorist attack our nation has ever known. 88 Australians died here, and they did not die alone. 38 Indonesians died with them. In all, 202 lives were lost, and more than 200 were injured. The bodies of the dead and the living bore wounds more often seen in wartime, but these were not soldiers. Our fellow Australians, those lost, those hurt, were doing nothing more than seeking a few carefree days amid full and busy lives. They had come to a place loved for its sunshine and its uncomplicated joy. A place like London and Gallipoli, where something of the Australian spirit dwells upon another shore. This is what the Bali bombers struck at. On September 11, terrorists attacked the great symbols of American prestige. Here in Bali, they attacked our people and through them sought to overwhelm our values. Here on these bustling streets, they inflicted searing pain and grief that will never end. But even as the debris fell, it was obvious the attack on our sense of ourselves as Australians, as human beings, had failed. Rescuers ran towards the terror. Volunteers extended their hands by the hundred, Indonesians and Australians alike. A remarkable medical effort swung into place. A thorough policing effort followed, methodically dismantling the terrorist network responsible. And our two countries drew closer than we had ever been before. Amid the horror, it was time for heroes, like Peter Hughes and Jason McCartney, victims who became rescuers. Like the Sangla hospital staff who provided frontline care in those critical hours. Or Len Natouris, Fiona Wood and their colleagues who were angels of healing back at home. It was a time for leaders too. President Megawati and Minister Udiono were quick to embrace international cooperation and a decisive security response. Prime Minister Howard was a steadfast, reassuring voice for Australians in those dramatic days, and I am delighted he accepted my invitation to be here today. It is so very fitting. Police Inspector General Pastika and Commissioner Keelty gave us confidence that justice would be done. 10 years later, and we witness today another sort of courage, the courage it has taken for survivors and families to make this pilgrimage. The physical journey by plane has been easy, but the inner journey is wrenchingly hard. This is a day of contesting emotions, from anger and unamended loss to forgiveness and reconciliation with a bitter past. Wounds and scars abound, healed and unhealed. But nothing can replace the empty seat at your family table, the graduations and the christenings you will never know, and the fault line that will always divide your lives into two halves, before Bali and after Bali. There are at least some fragments of comfort on this day of recollection and return. There is peace in this island and the knowledge that millions still come here for the same reasons you and your loved ones did. And perhaps there is a grim reassurance in knowing that the terrorists did not achieve what they set out to do. They did not undermine Indonesian democracy, which has only grown stronger across the passage of a decade. And though our vigilance is greater, we have not surrendered the freedoms that brought us here in the first place. We were hurt, and so were our friends, but we did not falter. Indeed, we endured and found strength in each other. With that strength, we embrace those who suffered in Bali and lost so much. With that strength, we affirm the endurance of our ideals. Because in the end, terror is not beaten by policing or force of arms alone. We prevail because we have a better way. We prevail because our beliefs endure. Terrorists have killed and maimed thousands around the world, but they will never sunder or displace a single ideal. So today we return here in remembrance, but we also gather in quiet defiance. We will never forget all that we lost. We will hold fast to that which remains, to our determination as a free people to explore the world unbowed by fear, to our resolve to defeat terrorism, and to our duty to care for each other.
Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard. The Prime Minister at the time of the bombings was John Howard. This is what he had to say at the special memorial in Bali.
To express our gratitude to the police and intelligence services of Australia and Indonesia and many other countries that tracked down and brought to justice those who had murdered your loved ones and left so many of you wounded and badly burnt. I salute, as an Australian who drew enormous pride at the time from the cooperative effort of all our agencies, I salute the Australian spirit that came through at the time. But I also salute the determination of people from different countries and different faiths to unite in the fight against terrorism. If there can be a legacy other than the sadness associated with these events, if there can be a legacy, it is the belief and the knowledge that as the years have gone by, the cooperation between our intelligence services has reduced, but of course never eliminated, the threat of terrorism. And it is proper, as the Prime Minister has said and the Governor has said and the Foreign Minister has said, at a time like this, to unite in our determination to oppose terrorism. Those who did these evil things would have hoped to have divided Indonesia and Australia. They would have liked to have divided Islam and Christianity and Judaism and Buddhism and other religions. But they failed in that as well, because out of this terrible deed came the interfaith dialogue, which allowed regional religious leaders to focus on what our religions have in common. And one thing they have in common is an abhorrence of violence, an abhorrence of murder, and a desire for peace and cooperation. Can I just finally say to all of those who have come here today with very heavy hearts and with a sad recollection of the loss of loved ones and a change in their lives that can never be turned back, the compassion felt by your fellow Australians all those years ago remains in a different form, but you are not forgotten, your loss is not forgotten, and the great memorial of those who you lost is to be found in the determination of the young of Australia to keep coming to Bali, to keep enjoying the hospitality of the Balinese people, and to retain and build further the friendship between the people of Australia and the people of Indonesia. Thank you.
And that was the special program that we did for the 10th anniversary of the Bali bombings. Well, you know what? We're nearly out of time, but we're going to be ending with music today. But before we get to that, I just want to remind you that our email address, of course, is focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. Next week, we'll be here for the first new show of 2013. The music world was shocked recently by the death of Indian music legend Ravi Shankar. So, we're going to end off with a little recording of him. Until next time, friends, this is Keith Parent wishing you all, hoping that you join us again very soon for another edition of Focus Asia Pacific. Bye-bye, everyone, and Happy New Year.